Hello, this is the operator speaking. The recordings have been started. You may begin now.
Thank you very much, André. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IR-TPC call on the 11th of September 2012. On the call today, we have Hugo De Fellow, Kevin Erdman, Simona Sebatiger, Mikey O'Connor, Barbara Knight, Paul Diaz, James Bedell, Matt Serlin, Philip Corwin, Andy Graves, Alain Béranger, and Avi Doria. We have apologies from Bob Mountain, Volker Gryman, Kelly Nayland, and Roy Dykes. And from staff, we have Marika Koenig, Glenda St-Géry, Barry Cobb, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the IR-TPC Working Group Call, September 11th, 2012. As per our usual procedures, if anyone has any updates to their statements of interest, please indicate by raising your hand in the Adobe room or shouting out now. Okay, no takers on that. And next, if you would please, if you have any updates or edits to our proposed agenda that was circulated on the mailing list yesterday and appears in the right-hand column of the Adobe screen, any changes or edits to that? Okay, no takers, so we will consider that agenda adopted. So there, we want to get through a number of things today. The first up is continued work on these beautiful diagrams from Mikey and the subteam that was working on that. Mikey, can I turn this over to you with the understanding that we're really under a time crunch and we can maybe spend a max of 15 minutes on this diagram, sir?
Ooh, I love that. That's exactly the number I was mentally telegraphing to you, so that'll work fine.
We're on the same frequency today.
Yeah, perfect alignment. I'll sort of shoot for 20 after the hour and go from there. So I circulated these quite late last night to the list. I apologize. I have been juggling a lot of plates. So I'm going to just highlight the changes to this, and we'll see sort of where this takes us. I've added a page. This first page is really the policy pieces. This is like the piece parts that we can use to build the use cases. So I've separated use cases from policy chunks. And what there really are is there are changes to the IRTP. There are, in chunk one, there's a whole new gizmo, which is the change registrant, and an associated safeguard to prevent registrar hopping. And then there's a chunk to speak to how the toggling on and off of that safeguard would work. So those are the policy parts. And then I take those policy parts and put them together into five use cases. So the first three are essentially identical to the policy pieces, but they should not be confused with the policy piece. The three things that we really need to write are the policy parts. The use cases are just used to describe how those things would be used. And in this first pair of slides, that's pretty subtle, but there you go. And in a minute, we'll get to exploding each of the use cases. Then the last of the use cases are the more complicated ones. There's the one where we change registrar and registrant at the same time, and we leave the safeguard on. And then the last one is the one where we turn off the safeguard and then change registrar and registrant. And I'll point out one puzzler that I'm still thinking about, and that is that the first time we talked about the removing of the safeguard, we said that both the old and the new registrant had to approve that. But with this notion of toggling the safeguard, that's not necessarily consistent throughout this. So in some cases, I have the current registrant toggling, and in some cases I have old and new approving. So there's still a little consistency to iron out here. Then we go into...
Mikey?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's a question in the chat that I'm afraid if you don't go too much further, you're going to leave some of us further and further behind. What do you mean by toggling the safeguard?
Well, let me get to it. I promise it'll become clearer when I get you through it. That's part of the reason why
so
we need these
slides. It's coming up, then.
It's coming up.
Thanks.
It's all coming. So let me take you through. So remember, we had three simple cases. The formatting got a little hosed up in the translation into PDF, but this is the first case, and you know, this is just good old IRTP. I want to move my domain from one registrar to another. The policy part that we have to focus on is that in order for this very simple use case to work, the registrant information needs to match between the two. And that was the puzzler we worked on last week, which is, well, how's that going to work in a thin registry? And we've got some options on that, primarily arising from the RIA discussions, where there's an emerging idea of uniform who is, that if that emerges the way it looks like it's going to, would provide a mechanism for the gaining registrar to query the who is data from the losing registrar in a consistent way, even in a thin who is environment. So I'm glossing over a pretty long conversation. I won't go into any more detail now, but we did have a pretty good call about that last week. So as long as the registrant information doesn't change, IRTP remains the way it goes, and this is just an additional requirement that would have to be added to IRTP. There's a bunch of conversation that I went ahead and answered. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail on this either, just to point you to it, that we indeed are going to have to change the way the current domain transfer process works if we do this. Et cetera, et cetera. The next case is unchanged. Basically, this is the registrant is changing registrant. She does it the way we've described in this new policy, where she changes it and then there's a lock that leaves the safeguard in place for 60 days. The next one is the toggle safeguard. And this arose from a conversation that started on last week's call, where we said, well, people may want to be able to turn this on and off. So there are really two cases here, and I've combined them into one. Up in that top paragraph, Susan either wants to waive the safeguard in anticipation of a transaction, so she wants to turn it off, or she wants to reinstate it, maybe because something didn't pan out or whatever. And the key there is that note at the bottom, which says that in either case, the authentication to do that would need to be very rigorous. And so we've got language that we're going to have to wrestle over in the policy in order to get that squared away. Because I think without very strong authentication out of band, we don't actually accomplish anything, because if somebody's hijacked the account, they can just toggle it off and steal the domain. And so all of this pain that we've been through is for naught. The next one is the one that is likely going to happen a lot, especially in cases where the registrant information can't be validated between registrars, which means that in today's case, where we don't have a good way to transmit or validate who is information between registrars in thin registries, this is really the default use case. And in this case, they will change registrar and registrant at the same time and leave the safeguard in place. And then the final one is the one where an investor wants to buy a domain and she wants to move it to a new registrar and have the flexibility to immediately move it along. And again, this is the toggle safeguard, but here it's waive the safeguard, and I wasn't sure whether I was looking at two things or one thing. So I left this inconsistency in here as something that I think we still need to iron out. So that's it. That's my story with 5 minutes to spare. Now let me circle back to the chat.
I'll go ahead and run a queue here, Mikey. And,
okay.
But I just want to say thanks for you and the sub-team. These are really impressive diagrams. I think they do introduce, I'm not sure if they introduce new information or just maybe put it in such a clear way that it raises some questions. So we'll circle back. I know Simonetta has some things. I want to put myself in the queue because I have some questions, and then anyone else wants to jump in, go ahead. But we'll start with Simonetta.
Hey, Mikey. I have a couple of clarification questions, I guess, and one little suggestion if we are going to use those slides as part of our report. I think it would be good if we do so to use on the first one or two or three slides where you introduce the use cases, if it's made more clear on these slides that these individual items, if you scroll up even further, I somehow didn't quite understand that, like, one and two and three isn't, like, a process step of the same use case, but they're really, like, three or four or five different use cases. So if we could write use case one, change registrar, use case two, change registrant with default safeguard, blah, 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 and so on. So that was the first, that kind of just confused me. And then I think the other thing that I still don't quite understand is what exactly we're meaning with the safeguard. So maybe you could explain a little bit what your thoughts were there. Is this just, is the safeguard basically a some kind of request in the account to do what, really? What were your thoughts there?
Thanks, Simon, and I think the first suggestion is terrific, and I will go through and make it really clear the difference. Some of this was sort of late-breaking editing last night. In terms of the safeguard, it's really a certain number of day anti-IRT lock. So basically, I think that the easiest way, for at least that I've been thinking about it, is if we change registrant, the default would be that after the change of registrant, there would be a 30 or 60 day lock that would prevent inter-registrar transfers from happening. And the thought here is to prevent registrar hopping. And so I think what I'm hearing is that I need to clarify that from the language that's sitting on these slides to make that clearer. Does that clear it up for you if I describe it that way, or does that still leave you confused?
No, but if safeguard means lock, why don't we use that word? Because that word is known in the ICANN world and will make immediate sense to people, whereas safeguard is not really defined or known. So I think that more people reading the report will have the same question mark in their head that I had. They just don't know what that safeguard means.
Yeah, I think I did that because on some call somebody said, "Ooh, don't use the word lock," and so I was being a good scout. But I agree that lock means more to me than safeguard. And so if that's a friendly amendment for the rest of the group, I would change this to do that, to clarify what this means, because I think it also helps with the implementation, because people know how to implement locks. They don't know what we're talking about when we implement safeguards. So
So is it then right, and correct me if I misunderstood this, that basically the idea that you're presenting here is that by default, when a registrant changes, there would be a lock, but that
right.
lock can be removed somehow with this toggle mechanism, whatever that is.
Correct. Precisely correct.
Okay, so really the toggle, the post-change lock, okay, there is, actually it says lock. So what that third use case means is basically a mechanism to remove the lock on use case two and or others, or what, or did I misunderstand that?
Well, this is where I've confused you with the difference between slide one, which is policy components, and slide two, which is use cases. And so I clearly need to make this distinction clearer. These two slides are identical. It's just that what I was trying to get at was the idea that in this first slide, from our vantage point as writers of policy, these are the three things that we need to write. But we need to write them in such a way that we can actually use them in at least five ways. This is the first three of the five ways, and this is the last.
Ah, okay. Then maybe another suggestion would be to just make two more slides that kind of, like one initial slide that introduces the distinction, and then in between the policy component slide and the one where you start the use cases, just one that basically says use cases on it, and then it kind of flows
yeah,
in a more
a
structured
idea.
Way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then on the use cases, I see. So on the use cases, you would have a independent use case number three from two or one or any one of the others that is describing a mechanism to remove that lock.
Correct. Or reinstate it.
Okay, I see. Got it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Those were good. James, go ahead.
Hi, Mikey. Thank you. And putting my registrar hat on here for a moment. I think this is good. I think I was a little confused as well as drawing the distinction between policy and the automation components. But I have this concern about the, and I'm not really sure if this is coming from the group or if it's something that we, kind of discuss in a larger venue, but this concept of being able to turn on and turn off the lock or toggle or safeguard, whatever we want to call it, but the ability to activate and deactivate that as needed. So I have some thoughts here. One is that we can make that the default, and we can certainly have change of registrants folks opt out of it for aftermarket transactions. But being able to then come back later and turn it on seems like a very significant development and procedural effort for relatively little benefit, in my opinion, because that's the folks that explicitly opt out and then later decide they want to opt in. We're basically saying that a domain investor has changed their mind and decided to willingly and voluntarily lock their domain name against transfer. If there's a concern, excuse me, for hijacking, I mean, most registrars have a number of products that could, or services or free functions, facilities to do this already. And then the ability to come back later and unlock it if that's misapplied is already established or was already established with IRTPB, which says something along the lines of, upon the request of the registrant, the registrar has to remove those kinds of safeguards within five calendar days. So I feel like we're introducing complexity that doesn't, I mean, it's the payoff isn't there. It's kind of where I'm driving at. I feel like I get what it's saying, and it makes the whole process more have more integrity. But it seems like we already have some mechanisms in place to address with the turning on and the turning off of this safeguard, and building it in or baking it into this policy, and it seems to really, really complicate this picture. So that's my thoughts there, and I would submit that to the group that perhaps we just say that it's the default toggle or safeguard or lock, and that you can opt out of it, but the ability to come back later and turn it on and off seems like a much bigger step. So I see there's a queue building up behind me, so I'll go ahead and go to submit.
Let me query the queue and just check and see. Are you guys, Simonetta and Avery, are you interested in talking about this thing that James was talking about, or should I respond to that before you talk? Because if you're responding to James, by all means, go ahead.
I'm going to question James.
Okay. Simonetta, you too? Or do you have another point? Simonetta, you may be muted.
I want to talk about James' comment also.
Oh, okay. So let's let Avery jump the queue, and then we'll circle back to
Simonetta. Would jump it first, and she's also talking about James' comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I read it backwards. Go ahead, Simonetta.
I was just wondering if, and I heard what you said, James, and my reaction was the same thing with if we already introduced this as part of IRTPB. My question was, is it really that much more complicated, or is it just the new safeguard and toggle language that makes it sound a lot more complex than it really is? Because if we're just speaking about locks that are there by default, can be disabled and can be reset, I mean, a mechanism to put to lock a domain name or unlock the domain name is already in most registrars' interface anyway, so I don't know if that is actually that complicated. If we're starting to speak about safeguards and toggles and all kinds of other things, then it sounds a lot more complex than what the idea really is.
So, Simonetta, maybe this is a question for Mikey as well. You're saying that existing lock functions would qualify under this new language, and that we wouldn't have to go out and develop a completely new kind of lock?
I wouldn't know why. If there is a lock that basically is set once a change in registrant is made or a change in registrar is made, but there is a mechanism for people to remove that lock somehow, and then they can just relock the name if they wish to not leave it locked anymore. That's something that most registrars support anyway, I think, including GoDaddy.
Yeah, if that's the case, then I'm okay with that, and I think we should just explicitly say that to eliminate confusion. But I was concerned that we were building a distinctly separate lock.
And this is Mikey. I am interested in the idea of, instead of building a new lock, using an existing lock. I think the reason I mentally built a new lock is because this is a new policy, this change of registrant thing. So that's the only reason I did it. Avery?
Yeah. First, I want to speak to the question that came up about why would you want to relock it? Basically, if the person that was doing the domain name sales wanted it open so that they could turn it quickly, why would they? I was thinking that it was the person who had acquired it.
Right.
Would want to reset the lock, and I'm not sure that there's an automatic mechanism in that transfer that would relock it. So I think that if I've bought a name from you know, some domain sales person, and now I have it, I want to relock it. So that was my notion, that the person acquiring it would be the one wanting to reset a lock normally. There could also be reasons why, you know, the person doing domain sales would do it. I don't know how that business logic works. In terms of the locks, I think if there is an existing lock and that it doesn't have any uses where having been set or unset by this set of policy processes would warp its effect, I think using the same lock is really great. I think the only thing we need to make sure is someone that understands the complete function of the lock the existing lock or the existing defined lock to make sure that there's no case where, and naively, I don't see it, but just looking at it from the software engineer perspective, that there is no use case where that other lock would be in a different state than this lock in a reasonable use case. But otherwise, I think using an existing lock is a good thing. Though software-wise, you just have to be careful that you're not overloading meeting and confusing yourself in the future. Thanks.
Yeah, I get all that. And actually, I get both sides of that. I think in terms of your reinstate thing, Avery, typically what I would expect is that if you're doing the change registrant and registrar at the same time, that you would just, when the transfer to a new registrant took place, the default would be to throw that lock on. And so that would be use case 4. And so one of the interesting things that came up on the call, the working group call. Oh, James, by the way, I'm paying attention to the clock here and note that I'm chewing your agenda all to shreds.
Yeah, we need to move on to Hago, and then we probably need to put a button on these charts because we still have a number of open questions. Thanks.
I think maybe this says that we need another one of those subgroup calls. So I'll go ahead and throw a question out on the list on that, and we can. We made a hell of a lot of progress on the last subgroup call, so maybe we can do that again and iron out some of this stuff. Here you go. Go ahead.
You have two options, lock or unlock. I want to ask you which of them of two procedures is the best, the lock or unlock, and why you choose one of these, lock or unlock. Okay.
Hago, your connection is just fuzzy enough that I didn't quite hear you. If you could speak just a little bit slower, that would help me a lot.
Okay. You have two options, lock or unlock. If you choose lock or unlock, I would like to know the best procedure and why. Why you choose lock and why you choose unlock. The benefit between them. Thanks.
Yeah, so what I hear you saying is that we really do need to describe the lock. And what I did in this is I made one use case, and I combined the two. What you're saying is we really need two use cases here, one to lock it and one to unlock it, correct?
Yes, come on.
Okay. I agree. I was cheating. And you caught me, and I apologize. I think that's I agree with that we do really need two use cases there. Thanks, Hago. James, back to you.
Thanks, Marika.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I just have a last clarifying question, but maybe that's something that can be clarified in further notes or discussions on this. Because I think on the first case, you mentioned that this would result in further changes to the actual change of registrar process, and it wasn't clear to me whether you're talking about whether this means actual change to the IRTP or you're just talking about implementation of the change of registrar. It might be something that just needs to be clarified so it can actually be incorporated accurately in the report. So I'm just thinking ahead of when you're revamping the report to put the right language in there. So if you have an answer now, feel free, and otherwise if you can clarify later.
I have a tentative answer, which I think is just Mikey shooting from the hip here. But my tentative answer is that yes, the IRTP needs to change in order to accommodate this, because I think, and it's the note that's on the bottom, that in the IRTP we need to acknowledge that the registrant information cannot change during the IRTP. And so I think that's a change to the policy on the IRTP side. That's part of the reason why these use cases are pretty important and why we need to make the distinction between a complex use case where we are doing two policy chunks at the same time, and a simple use case where we're only using one piece of the policy. But in order to make sure that that use case is truly pure, we need to acknowledge in the policy that registrant information cannot change as a result of IRTP.
Well, it looks like we still have a number of gaps that need to be filled here, but I think that this group has come a long way. I think that we... Hello?
Oh, I think that's Hago. Hago, you may still be... You may need to mute.
Okay,
Simonetta,
so,
let me just briefly address Simonetta's...
Very briefly, please, Mike.
Chat. Well, this was the subject of the whole call last week, and I think it's critically important that Simonetta is absolutely correct that today in the .com thin whois environment, it's extremely difficult for registrars to validate whois information because there's no mechanism to do it. And so there's really two options. One is, well, there's three. One is to force people always into use case four. Another is to acknowledge the coming uniform whois requirements that may arrive in the new RAA. And the third is to acknowledge the possibility that thick whois PDP may address this. But Simonetta is absolutely correct that today this doesn't work, and thus the default, if we were to implement this today, would be that registrars for transfers in .com would have to use use case 4 or 5 in order to accomplish this and essentially treat the registrant information as unknown. So there you go. Quick summary.
Okay. Thanks, Mikey. And thanks, everyone who's working on this. I think some good questions, a healthy discussion, and we'll... So the follow-up is, Mikey, you're going to circulate another doodle to reconvene that group to address some of these loose threads and circle back next week. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And if we can take, 90% of that discussion to the mailing list, I think that would be great, because I'm concerned a little bit that our number of Tuesdays between now and Toronto is dwindling, and we still have a lot left to do. So.
Well, and I caution people that, we're still at sort of the conceptual design level here, and after we get this hammered out, we have to write policy. So I am a little concerned that we are not going to make Toronto with this. Sorry.
Well, and maybe we can discuss on the list as well. My thought when we initiated this project, if it was sort of visual aids for what we were already discussing in the narrative, and it seems like now the diagram is driving the narrative instead of the other way around, or maybe I'm missing something, but I think we need to, if we can just move to the next item in our agenda, we'll definitely circle back on this next week and make sure that we have this buttoned up. Just because I do think it raises some important questions, and sometimes the diagram shakes out those conversations the way that text just doesn't have the ability to do. So thanks, everybody. I do appreciate that, and my desire to keep us moving is not to, in no way, a discount to the importance of the work, just recognition that other things are also weighing down on us here. So next up is the agenda item number 4, where we tackled our open issues. We only had one open issue for Charter Question B, and very naively, I thought that it was low-hanging fruit. We dove into it last week, and it turns out that was quite a lengthy discussion. I put a straw man out onto the list, and I know that there have been a number of edits to that, from Bob, Simonetta, and I believe Barbara, as well as some other folks weighing in that they supported it as is or with one or more of these changes. So perhaps, Marika, I see your hand is up. You can bring us up to speed on where we are with this this consensus call on this text. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to clarify what is up on the screen, what I did is take the latest language that was out on the mailing list, and basically this incorporates, if I'm right, the Simonetta's suggested edits, which I think are the ones that are highlighted, and, you know, the strike-throughs. It includes the suggestion that was made by Bob, which is in the green language in the top part, and I also incorporated the suggestion that was made by Barbara on the mailing list just before this call. So at the top, you see the marked-up language, but what I did below is just clean that up so it might be easier for people just to look at the clean version of that. And I think this is the latest based on the comments, but if I've missed anything, you know, please let me know, and happy to update it further.
Thank you, Marika. I really appreciate you consolidating those, particularly for someone like me who ran from one call to this one without catching the last two or three posts on the mailing list. So I definitely appreciate that this is the most current markup at the top and then the clean one at the bottom. Simonetta, I see your hand is up. I was wondering if we could walk through this first, or did you have something preliminary that needed to we need to address before we do that?
Go ahead.
Simonetta?
She says go ahead in the chat.
Oh, okay. I see. Okay, so we'll hold your place in the queue, Simonetta, once we get to walk through. So let's start with the we'll just go through the markup, I think. But the working group concludes that the forms of authorization, FOAs, once obtained by a, and we strike gaining because we note that it's actually more involved than just gaining, that was too narrow, by a registrar, should be valid for 60 days. Following this time period, the or a registrar, and maybe that's a question, must reauthorize via new FOA any transfer request. Registrar should be permitted to allow registrants to opt in to an automatic renewal of FOAs if desired. And I think that addresses Bob's part of Bob's question. In addition to the 60-day validity restriction, FOAs should expire if there is a change of registrant, or if the domain name expires, or if a transfer is executed, or if there is a dispute filed for the domain name. So we essentially lay out the events that would trigger an expiry. In order to preserve the integrity of the FOA, there cannot be any opt-in or opt-out provisions for these reasons for expiration. So essentially saying these are not within the registrant's control. If they happen, the FOA is killed. End of discussion. Here's the green text that Bob has added, correctly pointing out that we forgot that IRTP-B requires losing registrars to send FOAs as well. So here's the part that covers that. Losing registrants under IRTP-B are now, I think he meant registrars there, Marika, just a thought. But losing registrars under IRTP-B are now required to send an FOA to a losing registrant. I don't think losing registrant is defined. I think we want to say previous registrant, something along those lines. The working group advises that losing registrars have the option to send a modified version of this FOA to losing registrant in the event that the transfer is automated, where the FOA would be advisory in nature. So maybe we need to circle back on that because I think I have some questions there, so we'll get that when we come to the queue. Finally, and this is not part of a policy recommendation, this is just more of an observation here, that during the course of the deliberations on this topic, the working group notes that the use of EPP authorization info, auth info keys, has become the de facto security mechanism in our industry and thereby replaced some of the reason for the creation of the standard FOA. We recommend that future efforts in this area examine whether the universal adoption and implementation of EPP auth info codes should eliminate or would or could eliminate the need of FOAs. I just wanted to note there that in the previous sentence we say auth info keys and then later we say auth info code, so we should probably standardize on one or the other. I prefer code, and I think that one's on me because I wrote, there's no markup on those two words, so that one falls on me. Okay, so let's take a cue on this language, but I think the goal is if we're going to say we don't support the language, we definitely have to offer up an alternative because we have a strong, compelling desire to arrive on something, bring this one in for a landing if we can today. Okay, so let me, I'm going to jump to Marika just in case she has some clarifying language or a question, and then we'll start the queue with Simonetta. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just more on the last part of the recommendation, just a question whether the working group envisions that this should be part of the next IRTP, and if so or if not so, I think it would be helpful to clarify that so that the council is clear on what the working group means with future efforts.
Oh, that's a good point, and I was thinking about that as well when we were writing it. It begs the question of, well, when are we going to address this, if not now? And I think that we could discuss whether it should be part of future PDPs like IRTPD or whether it should essentially just be be left kind of open-ended. We'll leave that one to the group. We're going to go Simonetta, then Mikey, then myself. So, Simonetta, go ahead.
I wanted to respond to Barbara's last comment on the mailing list, which was this reintroduction of the should be permitted to allow registrants in the second sentence. The reason I had, because I was originally there when James sent out his initial draft, and I removed it because I was thinking of the user of the policy who, if they're like a fairly educated domainer, for example, they might be knowledgeable enough to identify registrars that support a process like this versus some other folks might not be that knowledgeable. And I would actually think that this option to pre-opt into FOA should be something that any registrar should offer, not just the ones who would like to. That's why my recommendation would be to not make it that optional, but to really say that registrars should allow registrants to opt into an automatic renewal of FOAs if desired. But, I mean, obviously, I'd like to hear what the rest of the group thinks about that.
So, and just so I'm clear, the intention was that some registrars might want this 60-day time period to automatically renew, and you're saying that instead of saying that it should be an option, you're saying it should be a requirement. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, because it would leave the users confused, because with some registrars something works and with others it doesn't, and it's completely intransparent which ones are the ones that support this and which ones aren't. And if the transfer policy and the transfer process, as we have all seen in the very initial attempts of getting a name moved, are so all over the place and so complex anyway that creating extra complexity because some people do something and other registrars don't do the same thing, I don't think we're doing the users a favor if we go that route.
So just so I'm clear, we're creating a new rule, and then we're requiring registrars provide the ability to waive that rule. I'm just hammering this out in my head because I think there's a truth table buried in this statement somewhere, but I need to think about that one. I'm not entirely sure what. Let's put a note there, Simonetta, and let's move to Mikey, and then let's circle back to that. And maybe others would like to weigh in on that as well. I'll go ahead and take the bottom part of the queue. Go ahead, Mikey.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. I'm going to comment on that same sentence, and it may be that my comments will even further cloud the truth table or not. We'll see. Remember that this sentence was essentially a concession that was made to the aftermarket community when we originally set this up, we were really working on how long should they be valid. No, they should not be valid forever. They should expire. And we came up with that list of reasons why they expire and this length of time. The concern from the aftermarket community is that in many cases their business model depends on being able to leave that authorization in place for quite a long time, much longer than 60 days, so that then when a domain is transferred, it can happen very quickly. And so we added the language that said that registrars should be able to get registrants, give registrants the option to opt out. My concern here is that what we are essentially doing is removing a safeguard. I mean, the reason for the FOA expiring is another anti-hijacking safeguard. And so my comment was going to be, and still is, that if we could include language similar to the language that's evolving in the first part of the call that says this, the authentication for this needs to be out of band. It needs to be much stronger than simply authenticating within an account. I'm comfortable. If somebody can hijack somebody's account and then turn off the FOA limit safeguard that we've just built, then I'm getting edgy about that. And at the same time, I'm a little edgy about requiring every registrar to offer that option if they don't want to. Because, again, if I were a registrar that wanted to make sure that these domains were secure and didn't run away, I don't think that I would be comfortable as a registrar being required to offer that option to my customers. So there's a rant.
Thanks, Mikey. I put myself in the queue on a separate topic, but I wanted to weigh in on this. I agree. I think that by adding this or requiring all registrars to offer an opt-out, or not opt-out, but an automatic extension, is essentially the same thing as saying FOAs never expire. So it's kind of like we've come completely full circle on the initial recommendation, which is that FOA should expire in 60 days. And then we're saying, but really they don't expire. I have some concerns about that. I feel like we have now undone our initial statement. So my feeling is that, or at least initially, I thought that, for example, I think it's along the lines of where you were going with this, Mikey, is that the primary market, say 80-20, the primary market would not have perpetual FOAs. They would expire on 60 days. And then there was this carve-out to support an acknowledgement and a recognition that that was problematic for the aftermarket, so that for that group, there was this special facility. Now it seems like we kind of want to flip that on its head and say, no, 100% of folks will behave according to the carve-out or the exception. And, so I guess I'm kind of coming down on the same area that Mike, you landed on, which is that I'm I think we've built something in, and then we've chipped away at it to the point where I can't see it anymore. I understand Simonetta's point is that this is a confusing process. I think that the message needs to be that FOAs expire, and the upsell or the exception from those folks who choose it would be to communicate to their customers and their registrants that we have a service, so we have a facility to extend the validity of your FOA, but not that being more of the exception than the rule. So the other thing I had here, and maybe it's really just language crafting at some point here, which is that I think that there was a I was concerned or at least confused a little bit why some folks changed the to any in front of transfer in a couple of places. I was specifically writing this to with the understanding that an FOA was attached to a specific transfer, not any transfer, and that if another transfer were to initiate, let's say I have a domain name and there's a transfer initiated at Rob Golding's registrar, that would have an FOA, but if there was a separate transfer initiated at Matt Serlin's registrar, for example, that would have a separate, distinct FOA associated with it. And I'm concerned by saying any transfer or something like that. Maybe I've got this backwards. Maybe we do need it to say any, but I was thinking that there was a one-to-one relationship between FOAs and transfer requests, and that by changing the to any, we were blurring that one-to-one relationship. So that was my thought and concern on that regard. I see that we are running out of time, but I think we want to get to a point where we can at least put some language up to the list for folks to consider. Any thoughts on this here? I noticed that we're coming up against the top of the hour.
James, the chat's pretty much running your way.
I've completely lost on the chat here. So let's see. What are we saying here? Matt and Barbara. Okay.
This is Barbara. I'd like to make a recommendation: is to put out a clean set of language, with the things you mentioned, and then just try it next over the week, and then at the next meeting, try and call it and determine. I think at this point, there's certainly near consensus on it, and not having contributed much to it other than an agree check at one point. But I think I would say that, write down the language, make sure that this is the language that there is, at least near consensus, then check if there is anyone that feels to say something against it, and go on from there. But I think you are right. We are close.
Aubrey, do you think there's a benefit to, even if it's somewhat arbitrary, to putting a deadline into that, like by the end of this week, we're going to, you and I together will make some sort of determination on whether we're a consensus or not, and then
can make a recommendation for where we're at a consensus, certainly with a deadline, certainly any time, and then we can always be forced to revise it.
Okay. Okay, that looks good. Folks, I notice we are at the end, and unfortunately I do have another call to jump onto, such as the life of every ICANN critter, and I'm sure everyone here can relate. I thank Mikey and the sub team for their diagrams and everyone who has weighed in on the list. And I know I sound like a little bit like a broken record here, but we have a number of open issues relative to Charter Question A that need to be addressed. And we're probably going to need to make sure that we emphasize those deliberations on the mailing list, because the time on our calls is becoming increasingly dear. So if we could please watch the list and please contribute there, that would be fantastic. I see, Marika, you get the last word here before we sign off for this week.
Just to clarify, because I've been trying to keep note on the changes that people suggested, would you like me to send out an updated version based on the discussions we had now, or would you like me to send it to you, or?
Marika, let's maybe... Maybe you and Avery and I can work offline and try to come up with a new set of language that reflects the changes today.
Okay, I can just send you what I took note of, and then you can see if that that makes sense.
That works great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks, everyone, and appreciate all of your work on these issues. I think we are getting closer, and I think someone once wisely said that the work gets harder as you get closer to the end, and I think that is... definitely the case in ICANN PDP. So thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week, same time.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thanks, right. James.
Thank you, Andre. You may now stop the recording. Thank you very much.
Thank you.